Whether it's a midweek game on the continent or a big weekend clash, cash in with your soccer knowledge on Prize Picks, America's number one fantasy sports app. Download the app today. Use code MIB for a first deposit match of up to $100. This episode is sponsored by Audible, the home of storytelling. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalogue. Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. I'm currently listening to The Secret Hours by Mick Herron. That's the standalone prequel to the majestic Slow Horses television series. I can't stop listening. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/courage or text courage to 500 500. That's audible.com/courage or text courage to 500 500.
This is Rebecca Lowe, or Rebecca Lua if you listen to Suboptimal Radio, and you are listening to Men in Blazers on the NBC Sports Network.
It's unbelievable.
It's coming, Rome.
It is coming, Rome. Rog, what an amazing, amazing 2.5 hours of football.
It felt longer.
From the Embassy Row Studios in the crap part of Bedford and the crap part of the South Fork of Long Island. It's a Men in Blazers Spotify Green Room Euro 2020, played in 2021, instant reaction pod.
Oh, mate, they will be going bonkers on the set of Gomorra tonight, Dave.
They'll be going bonkers all over Italy. That's a game I wish I'd watched in Italy, Rog. It would have been something else.
Oh, you just have to settle for the Hamptons.
Yeah, I was at my favourite restaurant, Pierre's, a little French restaurant there. The whole wait staff, me and my mates all watching it together. Incredible, incredible spectacle of football without being a particularly good game. But anyway, we'll talk about it. We are here, Rog, on Spotify Green Room, where we've been doing live broadcast every match day of the tournament. Good job. It's just an audio platform, so people can't see that you haven't changed pants in weeks, apparently.
Not wearing any, mate.
As you know, at this point, we post these Green Rooms as podcasts immediately after they're complete. But let's just say these are like the director's cuts. There have been parts of the live broadcast that have been edited out for the pod versions. Plus, being on the app is the only way you can participate in the Q&A section.
Oh, mate, being live on Green Room with us, it's like being in the Bada Bing when it all kicks off. And I did love Saturday's Green Room when we had an England supporter, the now almost famous Chris Willis, live from Kent, breaking the news that when England won the game, it just realised how badly he needed to, quote, make a poo. And that wonderful Danish supporter gave a live report from Copenhagen in a little more measured fashion, let's be candid. We're hoping to have both of them back tomorrow because we need a bowel update, David.
Live from Kent. So that's something you'll never hear. And for those of you, actually, you know, we're about to have the Open Championship live from Kent. I take that back. For those of you on Green Room with us right now, no matter which cabin you're in, ask your questions on the chat section and we'll take the best ones at the end of the show. Can you kick this whole thing off with a toast, Rogelio?
Oh, mate. By the way, before I do, can I just say follow Davo, follow Roger on the Green Room app so you know whenever either of us goes live. Obviously follow Men in Blazers and gem us up in the face. We want those gems. I am about to open my 17th 18th bud of the afternoon. It's really quite dark for Rog when he has the Green Room after extra time and penalties. The players think they have it hard, Davo, but Rog is just pouring them down. I want to raise my first 18th bud of the day, really, to the semi-final of Euro 2020. Four teams enter, two teams leave. I mean, what a treat for the senses. Four deeply compelling narratives, the stories these teams tell themselves about themselves. All of them go into this believing they have the best case to be the team of destiny. And it is always, for me, the most remarkable moment in the tournament. One game, just a single game each day in the spotlight, a crucible of pressure in which legends are made, national heroes forged, Donnarumma. Oh, and misery. Oh, why Morata? Why did it have to be Morata, you bastards? Agony, searingly felt. I raise this Bud Fam, Blood Fam to high stakes tournament football. It's the greatest human theatre.
Yeah, Absolutely, Rog. Italy 1, Spain 1. Italy win it on penalties. After a nip and tuck first half, it was Italy who struck first in the 60th minute, an incisive counter that started back with Donnarumma and ended with Federico Chiesa curling one into the side netting just 13 seconds later. But 10 minutes from time, the much maligned Alvaro Morata, who'd come off the bench, drove through the gut of the Italian defense, played a tiny little give and go with Dani Olmo. Whoa, what a player he is, Rog. Before tucking one home and forcing extra time. After 30 minutes, in which the only winner was lactic acid, the game went to penalties, where Jorginho tucked home the winner after a little hoppity-skippity jump to send Italy into the Euro 2020, played in 2021, final.
Oh, mate, where to begin in this wet hair gel classico? A clash of styles. Mancini dressed for the boardroom. Oh, Luis Enrique dressed, well, for a Zoom meeting in his bedroom. Italy charged into the game, aware that they were the team who consistently played the tournament's most scintillating football. Spain, they only had one win inside of 90 minutes all campaign. However, Spain, and this is really important, and this is why to me the penalties were so shocking. Spain to Italy, really they're what Germany are to England. This was the fourth consecutive Euros where the countries have met. They played seven competitive fixtures against one another over the last 13 years, and Italy had won just once. This was, for me, as much a psychological test as a footballing one. Tiki-taka against a style known in Rome as Tiki Italia. And Miguel Delaney wrote that the belief is only goalkeepers, centre-backs and maybe strikers remain when it comes to Italy's tactics, but everything else has to be fluid and rotating. And that was, you know, that was the idea going in, but we saw a slightly different Italy. One enforced change, the crucial wonder, Davo. Spinazzola out with a cruel Achilles rupture, some drop-off, having Emerson of Chelsea in the lineup in Spain.
Yeah. Emerson of Chelsea, that's quite kind to Emerson. I've seen, I've seen Danny Drinkwater play more for Chelsea than Emerson. It's a, it was quite a drop-off.
Spain, no Morata. They chose to be fluid, mobile, a rotating front line. And so we went into it. Italy winning the national anthems, obvs. Somebody needs to get Hines to write lyrics to the Spanish national anthem right now. Italy bellowed theirs in a characteristic style. And then they won the handshakes. Oh, before kickoff, Cellini, so happy. He almost seemed high, Dave. You saw Busquets, who's won everything in football, just staring at Cellini during the coin toss like, chill, bro. Chill. What the hell is going on?
Whatever he's on, I want some of it. I'll take a quarter of it. But whatever it is, I want his drugs.
I think I've done what Cellini's done, and I just kind of stayed in the corner of the room with deep, deep anxiety. But the game began at full throttle. Spain pushed up high. Italy looked eager to break their high line, running at Man City, second string centre-back pairing at every opportunity. Spain unleashing mesmerising triangles. You can't beat us if you can't touch the ball. Oh, Dave explained before the game, Luis Enrique wanted a step up in intensity. And that was really the battle to enforce their idea. Both our teams starting to move the ball. Italy, swift, lethal, direct. Spain taking the long route every time. It was like Italy, David. They were like the express bus. Spain, willingly, by intention, they were the local one.
Yeah. But Italy, constantly giving the ball away as they tried to mount those very, very quick counterattacks. And Spain, unable in the final third to do anything really incisive with the ball. And so despite all the end-to-end action, the game was bizarrely stalemated, even though two teams were going and playing with just such attacking intent.
Until, the final third of the first half. I'm not very good at fractions. I don't really know what that is. Mathematicians in the comments, help Rog out, because suddenly the game became a bar fight. Busquets, Spain's shield, Pedri, the dagger, completed 100% of his 31 passes in the first half. Kid is 18, incredible. I remember getting a shaver when I was 18 and not knowing what to do with it. That guy was just dominating a game. It must have felt incredible. Italy, constantly trying to shake up the bottle of Coke they had in their hands and then open it. Both teams had chances. Unai Simon gifting Italy theirs. Donnarumma smothering Olmo. But you have to say, David, without Spinazzola, they were really like a a team with great receivers but no QB. They didn't have anyone really threatening.
Yeah, they couldn't get anyone down the wings really to overlap and create anything from the byline, anything from the top of the box. It was just, they were just coming straight down the middle again and again.
And at halftime, game notes say this game is going to have to be solved by the coaches. And so it seemed in that second half, which really came to life. Oh, tension, skill, both so high, total magic in the interchanges. Spain looked like they were going to create chance after chance. Busquets hammering a curling wonder just over the bar. But then, Davo, Italy broke full length of the field from Donnarumma's hands to the back of the net in just 13 seconds. A moment of astonishing, poetic wonder.
Yeah, the 60th minute. It was just a beautiful goal. And Donnarumma like saw it right from the beginning and then ended up on the boot of, you know, your favourite Italian player. Rog, you've been talking about him all tournament.
Everton's Chiesa.
Yeah, seems unlikely. And Chiesa curls it in. There's nothing more beautiful than a curled right foot Italian goal. They specialise in them and they scored them for years, Rog. And this was just a prime example.
Watching a master archer just unleash his bow. Can I just say, Donnarumma, I love him. This is a very niche tweet, but if you've seen the kayak commercial, he looks bizarrely like the kayak.
He's a skinny version of the guy in the kayak canoe.
When I watched the kayak commercial, I was like, oh my God, Donnarumma's English is excellent. He is going to pick up so many bloody endorsements. Plucked Olba's cross out of the sky. And then just immediately, a little bit like you see Alisson do for Liverpool, immediately bowling that ball out, getting something moving on the counter. Verratti, I think he found, who fed Immobile, who lost the ball under pressure. But when Chiesa swooped on it, it was heart-stopping as a moment. You could tell as he swooped upon that ball that he had already made up his mind what he was going to do with it before he'd so much as taken a touch. He dropped that shoulder. Finish was just 100% wizard filth. And as he ran off today, I think the only thing in his mind when he received the ball was, what is my celebration going to be? Because he knew he was scoring, Dave. He was just like, what celly am I going to do? He ran to the left corner flag, but then pivoted. That corner flag is not worthy. Charged towards the white. A lot of Americans watching the Euros for the first time are like, do these footballers train for knee slides? Because that was incredible. And it was incredible. What feelings do you think? What pure joy, Davo, must have flowed through his veins as he slid to the corner flag in celly?
Oh, it's a boyhood dream. I mean, he saw a picture, Rog. He saw a picture not only of the goal, he saw a picture of the entire celebration. I must say I feel bad for Laporte because that was an amazing challenge he made before the ball fell to Chiesa's feet. But it was almost like a Renaissance painting of a slow motion replay of a goal, celebration, cuts to the crowd, the EVS operator really doing his bit, having picked up all those great slow motion shots. Yeah. It was a tableau. It was a thing of beauty, and it was just oh so Italian.
And his face is classically Italian. We've been watching together football, you and I, for like the past 200 years. That face could come from any era. It's an astonishingly classical Italian football face. And his joy, it was like watching Artie Bucco get the veal pizziola just right tonight on the specials on the menu. I actually shouted, I've got to admit this, David, when Italy scored, you know, I watch a lot of football. I shouted at the television. A deep noise came out of me in a way I do not normally make for many teams or many goals, even ones I support. And I realised I love this Italian team so much, the way they play, the redemption story of Mancini, even their shithousery, Davo. To me, I love it all. Oh, and I was like, I wrote my game, this team deserves glory. But one thing about them, they only know how to hold on a lead by keep on going on. And Spain flung on that law firm, Moreno and Morata,
injury attorneys.
1-800, crap, goal. And Morata immediately pissed off, well, pretty much the whole of Iberia and received a million Twitter insults by refusing to shoot when open. But then, as if inspired by the hate, Davo, what a goal.
I think that's a dangerous argument because we can't make it seem like the hate and the death threats caused this to happen, or the people who made the hateful death threats are going to say, see, it worked. But
probably the best point you'll ever make.
It was a beautiful goal, and started Alvar Morata started it. The ball from Olmo, I could write a paragraph just on that. The little cushioned blow back into his
the caress of a tender lover.
Oh my God, it was so great, and Olmo was outstanding. Talk about someone's trade value increasing in just in a single game. He sent the ball back into Morata's path, and when he runs purposefully, when he moves purposefully, he is a much better footballer. And yeah, I just finished slagging him off at the point just 30 seconds before he slotted that in the back of the net. It was amazing to see.
It's like watching Liam Neeson in one of his action movies. Suddenly just transformed from just like normal dad into, I'll save you, children. It was just like, suddenly the Italian centre-backs, the vaunted Italian centre-backs, suddenly just looked at old David, old.
Yeah.
And the finish, I actually think Spain confused Italy by moving forward for the first time all game as opposed to just shuffling side to side. That was incredible. But when he celebrated, David, that was a thing of joy, watching Morata. Yeah. It was like, oh, it was Dumbo flying.
Yeah, no, it was a thing of beauty, of redemption in every single way, and just the pressure put on him. I mean, yeah, I love sports, Rog. You know this. I love all sports. I love everything with a bat, everything with a ball, everything with people, everything with competitions. I even love referees and umpires. But there is something I just loathe about sport, the abuse that athletes take from trolls online. I just cannot stand it. And the cowardice and making death threats against a man or a woman
family.
And their family is just the most sickening, sickening, awful, awful thing. And it's when it honestly makes me sometimes want to have nothing to do with sport because the fans can be such idiots.
You know, that reminds me of when John Oliver came on the show and we showed him a clip of West Ham Fan TV about a fan going mental that one of the players wouldn't give him a shirt and he was just going on for it. And he's got to give us the effing shirt. He didn't give us that effing shirt. We pay the money. He didn't give us. And John Oliver just looked at the clip and we came back to set and John Oliver just goes, something tells me about that man. It's not about the shirt. And there is a lot of this that is not about anything to do with the football. It's just a deep, psychological trauma that many human beings are in. By the way, I'm sounding like I'm excusing it. I'm not. I'm just saying if you feel that, get help because football is not going to help you in any way, shape or form.
Yeah.
But back to the football, it's got to be said, Spain deserved it. Looked all game like the stronger side, the side more in control. And from then on in, you know, Spain, extra time, third game on the run, first team to do that in the Euros, incredible. But looking at the added minutes, it was Italy that looked more gas, Dave. It was intriguing to see, Spain dominating, Italy hanging on. And I felt, you know, sad for both of them. They were just fighting at the end of the day to be annihilated by England, right? Bless.
Poor Denmark. to some extent, you know, Italy, I think, had slightly the better of the first 60 minutes, capped off with Chiesa's goal. And I think the next 60 minutes of the match, the 30 minutes of regular time and the 30 minutes of overtime, Spain had slightly the better of it, which is why it went. It was a game of two very, very, very long halves. But yes, at the end, I felt Spain's best chance to win it was probably at the end of regulation, those final, you know, crazy 13 minutes after Morata's goal.
But then, you saw Italy, who had dedicated their elite shithousery all tournament long to holding on to leads, had to pull out some new shithousery, time-wasting shithousery, clinging on for penalty shithousery. There's even a great minute when Mancini got on the ball on the sidelines and tried to hold on to it. I mean, it was old school. And I think it was only the motivation of being stripped to their underpants by delirious fans post-victory that kept them even standing up. And so it went to penalties. We've got to talk about Cellini again during the coin toss.
I mean, he won every moment of it.
It was what a boss, Dave. But he knows exactly. I mean, on one level, it is joyous. It's like, if you didn't see it, he's going for a coin toss. The pressure on these men in the run up to the penalties, the crucible of pressure is just insane. And there he is. He's just like, hey, he's laughing. He's joking. He's punching his opponent twice, slapping him in the face twice. Then they do the coin toss and he lifts him up in the air.
twice, thumps him up and down. He's a 36-year-old who still loves the game of football with as much passion as when he was a tiny kid. But there is an ulterior motive, right, David? It's like drunken monkey form of kung fu. It's to confuse, bewilder the opponent. We so mad, we feel no stress. We are inside your head kind of thing.
Yeah, and he's also a terrifying man. You know, by the way, he's a great man, but he's a terrifying man. You know, him and Bonucci, they are like, you know, talk about Gomorrah. They're like nightclub bouncers in a Milan nightclub. They are like, they're hardcore guys who use some of their own humor to disarm. But that was extraordinary. I've never seen anything like that in a football game, and we've seen almost everything.
Psychological strategies employed by Italy, but the master of penalty shootout psychouts, Unai Simon. I mean, just the king of icing the shooter. So many tricks he unleashed before the first kick. Locatelli, the way he moved on the line is just so unnerving. I can't stand it at home. But then Olmo.
Oh my God, I'm so glad you said that, because I said in front of everybody at the restaurant, I just don't think it should be allowed.
I mean, the penalty odds are in the shooter's favor. I think penalty shootouts are ridiculous. They're insane. They're just so cruel. But if that's the game they're going to play, that is a goalkeeper shaving the odds in his, which are against him, but trying to increase his percentages. What would you like him to do?
I don't know. I think in this tournament, we've seen so many penalties missed in both the regular action and also in penalty shootouts. I just feel it's a little bit wrong. I think it's very distracting the way that they really are still moving, even as the players are like running up to go and hit the ball. I don't like it.
Oh, it worked.
It just doesn't look right.
Olmo then got Italy back into the game with a shank. There was life. Ugh. And yeah, it just started off so CONCACAF-y in the face, this shootout. But then it all went down, Davo. Ultimately, Morata, you could tell as he walked to the ball that the hello darkness, my old friend, was about to go down. How much did you feel for that human being?
I feel awful for him, especially after the goal he scored and the redemptive story. And also because I know that he will be subject, him and his family, to more threats from the same complete nutter idiots who did it before.
I've got to say, I felt dark. I mean, God, you bastard gods of football. Why him? Why did you choose him? Heartless, heartless bastards. At the same time, the question is, if Luis Enrique, this is very much on you, the man manager, the penalty shootout strategy, to throw your gent into this crucible. I just thought he should never have been up at the spot. Daniel in the chat asks if it's better if he didn't score in the first place, Davo. It would have been less heartbreaking, like the fake redemption of his goal. It would have been better if he hadn't scored the goal and Spain would have just gone out 1-0. You know, you can't be hypothetical about history, Daniel. You really can't. It's like, would the, you know, if the plot against Hitler had worked, would the war have ended quicker? We can't answer those questions.
I don't think any professional athlete ever would say it would have been better not to have scored that remarkable goal and to have that memory and have that ability to have done that.
It's so bloody. And then you see who steps up, Davo. Jorginho. I mean, the greatest on his day, the greatest penalty taker in the game. And what did he unleash?
He unleashed the hoppity skippity, Rog. And sometimes he does it. Occasionally he doesn't do it. But it appeared that Unai Simon had never even conceived of the hoppity skippity. It's like he'd never seen him play.
Oh, it was incredible. The way he did it, it was as if we watched the Ice King just shatter. Unai Simon just shatter into a million pieces. It was just, I see you, Unai Simon. I see what you've done to penalty takers in the past. I am going to destroy you. If he stuck his hand into Unai Simon and ripped out his still beating heart, it would not have been any more debilitating. There was a ton of talk in the chat about alternate penalty formats, including allowing managers to take the penalties and allowing the teams to pick the opposing penalty takers. Oh, that is a cruel... That game would be on Fox. That game would be a Fox quiz game on Sunday night where you allow the teams to pick the opposing penalty takers. We will dive into that in the Q&A. Keep firing them in there. Dave, I've got to say, I feel for Spain. I mean, this was not an elite campaign. It was a campaign full of perseverance. They suffered complications from COVID. Sergio Busquets, his positive test result caused chaos. Mm-hmm. They overcame that. They overcame the lack of goals. They'll rise again. World Cup 2022 coming, I mean, peak for them. This was almost a tournament too early.
Yeah, they had some problems, and they never really... I think they played their best football of the tournament in this game as they got back into it in that second half of regular time. But they never really unleashed it all in this tournament. They never really clicked. I mean, the number of passes they hit is always remarkable. The number of, you know, chances they create is always remarkable. But they just never really seemed like on the cutting edge. And I think we have to say, over the course of the tournament, even though this was a very close game today, the better team in the tournament so far did win, and there is some justice despite, you know, many people's misgivings about penalty shootouts being a way to end a game of this magnitude.
I am thrilled for Italy. I was at the Euro final in Kiev 2012. It was a 4-0, just a battering. I mean, I think it's still the biggest win in a final. They just utterly destroyed the Italians, a third successive major trophy. It was I think even the Italian manager, a wonderful man, I really loved him, Cesare Prandelli, called it a perfect performance. They then, if we're looking most recently, this Italian team failed to qualify for World Cup 2018. And to bounce back, Davo, I think that loss to Spain in 2012 made the Italian Federation at every level, root and branch, look at how they were developing their young players, the style of football their national team was playing, and they really reinvented themselves. And so today, to defang their greatest opponents, to almost exercise just some of their darkest modern footballing moments, and to do it strategically, building back from 2012, surviving the humiliation, the deep humiliation. We didn't qualify. America did not qualify for 2018. That was dark. But Italy, I mean, football is so core to their identity. It'd be like America not getting a team into the Super Bowl. So I just admire it so unbelievably deeply. And for Mancini, particularly, a man on a mission of coaching redemption, savouring every second, that is so life-affirming.
Yeah, and there's something about this Italian team which is so appealing also, that they have multiple stars, of course, but there's no standout star on that team. You feel like all over the park, they have players who are as good on their day as everybody else on the team. And they work as a collective and they play football as a collective and they move between the lines so well. And, you know, defenders come forward. I love watching Chiellini today playing some of his long balls, which were just like, they took your breath away, not necessarily in a good way, but they're effective. He finds a way to contribute from the back. And there's something really unique about watching them play football. I enjoy it a lot.
I love it. I love it. I love it. I love it. Sta tornado a casa. Oh, it's coming Rome, David.
Yeah, it could be coming Rome. But then tomorrow, Rog, it is the big one, big one. England versus Denmark from Wembley. Again, Gareth, a slightly cut up Wembley. Gareth Southgate's side will attempt to guide the country to its first major tournament final. I don't know if you've heard this, Roger. It would be the first major tournament final since 1966 for England. Denmark, on the other hand, trying to replicate 1992 when they won the whole shebang. How are you seeing this one at this moment in time, Rogelio?
I am imagining there's a ton of comments, ton of questions about this, and I know we both want to get to that. So I'm going to keep this somewhat abridged. I say it's an astonishing moment in modern English football history. This is a once in a lifetime opportunity for these players to qualify for a final at home, Wembley Stadium, knowing that, you know, every game they play, the last two are both going to be played there. And I adore this Danish team. I really do. I'm not going to tell you who I'm cheering for tomorrow because it's just I'm an objective journalist and, you know, ultimately my feelings are irrelevant. I love this Danish team. I think they're going to be fantastic. I think they are absolutely locked in. I think they love being underestimated. I think they're having a laugh. They've won the Euros before. They know how desperate England are. And I think England's plan is always, as it has been from the very beginning, their sole goal is to prevent their opponent from scoring as their first and second priority. And I think what's going to be fascinating... They start fast, this England team, in big games. They often score very early. If they don't, Davo, I do think the advantage, Ged, the longer Denmark can keep themselves in this game, the longer they know just that pressure, that psychological pressure. You know, Simon Kuiper had a piece in the Financial Times today about how England's greatest opponent may be psychological pressure. His line, even Lionel Messi throws up before big games sometimes. It's a feeling you never get used to. I think that England, ultimately, the semi-final in the last World Cup, you kind of feel, ultimately, this game will be determined by Hendo, Raz, Harry Kane, Harry Slabhead, Picky, the guys who were there before. If they can give the young guns a sense of how to cope, England should do this.
Yeah, I mean, look, already it's remarkable just looking at the betting odds that England go into a semi-final of a major tournament at minus 141, Denmark plus 450 to win. That's a pretty serious advantage. And yeah, I totally agree with your analysis. I think that, you know, England are going to want to get on the scoreboard early and put some pressure on the Danes. Having said that, one of England's great advantages is just how stacked they are and how many great players they have on the bench. And I think ultimately it could be the quality of England substitutes that make the difference in this one. But a fascinating encounter and lots of questions about how England are going to set up to control the Danish pace on the wings, and how Denmark are going to you know, play some of England's key players.
Yeah, I mean, I will say we are blessed either way. A England-Italy final is just a game for the ages. It is. Everyone, I want everyone on this, in this green room, and I want everyone on the podcast to understand just how seismic that is for English football, just in terms of dreams and yearning. I'll also say a Danish-Italy final, two teams filled with joy and love who've given the world so much delight for the past month. We win or we win. Again, objective Roger is not going to reveal who he's cheering for, but Davo, let's go to the comments. And before we do go to the comments, I want to give huge love to producer J-Dubs, who is the voice in the comments producing this green room after green room. He just bloody lives in Spotify. More than he lives in his apartment, he lives in a Spotify green room right now. I want to take my hat off to producer J-Dubs and the whole Men in Blazers staff. You have been, I mean, whoever wins the Euros, to us, you've won the Euros. But let's get in with the GFOPs, David.
Here, here, Rog. Before we do that, just a reminder, we're going to be back here on Spotify Green Room to commune with you all tomorrow. That'll be right after the game, whenever it finishes. But right now, we want to get into that Q&A portion. We're going to call you up onto the stage, invite you to speak. When you move to the stage, please just remember to stay muted until we call on you. Rogelio, who is up first?
Oh, this is my favorite part of the day. I'm going to bring to the stage Mr. Blake Haberman. Where are you from and what's your question?
Hello. Hello, gentlemen.
Oh, you've got a voice for radio, Blake.
Oh, thank you. I'm calling from beautiful Boulder, Colorado.
Oh, mate, I am so jealous of you right now. And what's your question?
My question is, I know you've been discussing better ways to settle matches than penalty kicks. Do you think that bringing managers in to take a PK would make it more fair? And who would be your Euro and club favorite managers to take a PK?
Oh, what a question. What a question.
Well, it's interesting. Mancini in that suit versus Enrique in those.
It's Wranglers.
Quite tight. Levi's. I think that's the Levi's black label. I saw it. I recognize that gene.
I'm pretty sure he's got a Wranglers in these. Luis Enrique single-handedly bringing Wranglers back.
No, I think that's a 5'11 skinny fit gene, Rog. I think you'll find maybe a 5'10, but I think it's a 5'11 in the gray. Looks quite good with his slightly acid wash sweatshirt. You know, maybe Enrique had the advantage because of what he's wearing. I mean, you really want a manager who's in some kind of football kit, you know, a full kit wanker like TT, like Tuchel, dresses on the sideline. It would have been fascinating to watch Arsene Wenger in his puffer coat having to take one because the wind resistance would have been terrible. But yeah, I mean, it's a comically brilliant idea. And we should figure out how to do that for charity. I like it. I like it.
I mean, the reality is, I've said this before and I've said this again. Football is a team game, a collective game, 11 versus 11, unless John Joe Shelby's playing. And the reality is, the penalty shootout is an individual test. That walk, that long walk from the spot for the one human being, knowing the scrutiny of millions around the world is upon his or her back. The goalkeeper, you know, unleashing trick after trick. I mean, it's a ridiculous. It's like a Russian roulette of a torture, which is not only do they not train for it, but it's not even a skill set that you use game in, game out. A dance-off is as connected to the game of football that's preceded it as the penalty shootout. So the reality is, I think it's incredibly cruel. And if you're going to have managers do anything, why don't you have something that's actually fun to watch and that they're actually bloody good at? I watched Nathan's hot dog eating championship. I like Joey Chestnut. I think he's a good kid. But if you had Big Sam and Steve Bruce in a playoff at Wembley, mate, are you telling me, Dave, that would not do a rating?
Yeah, no, it would be good. I mean, look, the best idea I've ever heard, and there are faults with it too, just as there are problems with the penalty shootout, is, and it's been suggested by, you know, people way smarter about football than me, that you should do the penalty shootout before the game takes place to break an eventual tie. And it would protect players from having to play extra time, which is a huge disadvantage when you're going into the later stages of a tournament. And one team would know that they have to, if they fall behind there, they have to know that a draw isn't good enough and they'd be forced to play. The fear with that is that the team that wins the penalty shootout would then hold on for the draw. But I think you can see from this tournament, holding out for the draw is not a particularly easy feat to accomplish.
God, if you did have penalties and managers took them, Crystal Palace, Uncle Roy. I think someone in the chat said it would take Uncle Roy 30 seconds just for the run-up, David. But
but that might be why Vieira's got the job now. They want to do better in the manager penalty shootout.
I'm fascinated to see what Pep would do. I mean, really, what new, just next level 4D kind of penalty? I mean, he would take Jorginho's hop, skip and jump penalty to like the fifth dimension. Klopp would be amazing to watch. He'd probably lean into the goalkeeper and say, pull my finger! And as the goalkeeper reached forward, just blast the ball down the middle. Total toe bunger. We are going to bring another, oh my God, Benitez. That would be the Panenka from hell. Let's bring to the stage another GFOP, another great American name in the face, Casey Boyd. Welcome to the stage. Where are you from? What's your question, friendo?
Hey, Raj and Devo. I'm coming to you live from Eden Prairie, Minnesota.
Oh, America.
Yep. Right before kickoff today, HBO released the Season 3 teaser trailer for Succession, which
we
all know, aside from the Premier League scriptwriters, would be the dominant drama on television. So my question to you is, which of the Roy children would you prefer to take a penalty? Because Kendall seems a little Morata-like to me. So I'll go back.
Wow.
Wouldn't they all just disappoint their dad in one way or another? Oh, my God. What an incredible question.
Yeah, because the problem is, it would be, what would the writers have happen? How would they make it happen? It's not actually the characters actually alive. It's how would the actual... Oh, my God.
I mean, the reality is
it's got to be Siobhan. I mean, really, you've got to have Siobhan take the penalty. You feel like Siobhan is going to be calm, cool, and never going to miss.
Panenka would look at Siobhan and be like, no, my kick should be called the Shiv. It should no longer be called the Panenka. She has taken it to such a high art. I think Shiv, under pressure, would deliver. I mean, just by virtue of elimination, Kendall can barely cope with the pressure of getting out of bed in the morning. I mean, the crucible, the pressure that are penalty kicks, I that would be too excruciating. That would be like Morata-level excruciation to witness. My God. The one I would want to watch is probably Wham's Gang was shooting on Cousin Greg. I think the writers would get way into that one. That would be like a 15-minute classic Succession scene, just Wham's Gang's the psychological battle, Cousin Greg. There'd be a lot of water bottles thrown. By the way,
I mean, Roman would do the hoppity skippity. If there's anyone who's going to do the hoppity skippity, it would be Roman.
Yeah, Bruman would like just blast it way over the bar and look at the phone video of him blasting it over the bar. Now, you know, Bruman would have Jerry take it. That's what would happen. Bruman would send Jerry up. By the way, listen to our HBO Succession podcast. It is a joy to make. Go and revel in it now. Oh, Casey Boyd, you are just here to send me layups for these plugs. Gorgeous, gorgeous question, as is the one incoming from the great Greg Shelley. Greg, where are you from and what's your question?
I don't know whether to feel honored or not that I've been able to ask a few questions on these green room pods for a while, but I'm calling in from Wichita, Kansas again.
Hey, you're very handsome, Greg. I've got to tell you, that icon, I may have to borrow that as my headshot. You look like I want to look in my icon, but you're very handsome.
Well, that's very kind of you, and thanks for all the green rooms that you guys have been doing. My question is, dealing around Murata, we've heard a lot of conversation around mental health awareness in other sports. Aaron Rodgers, NFL, here recently says he's been focusing on that this offseason, then Naomi Osaka for tennis, but we don't hear too much of it in world football. So how does someone like Murata kind of rebound from this tournament of ups and downs? What can be done mental health-wise in the world of football?
What a great question.
Yeah. I mean, I think that Naomi Osaka issues and, you know, that she's had and very much has come out and stated that she's looking to protect her mental health and one has to respect her stand is a slightly different position than and situation than what we're dealing with Alvaro. He's not a player who's gone public and talked about mental health, as far as I know. And I would question the mental health of the people who are, you know, threatening him and making death threats. But of course, however healthy anybody is mentally, however their confidence is, whatever their support systems, however strong they are, however much they're able to focus on their sport and put it in context and focus on their life outside of sport, when you and your family are being threatened, there's no way for you to cope like that. So we can only hope that he's getting the support of his national federation, from his team, his fellow players, and from everyone else. I can't imagine it. I think it's shocking. And this is something that should be spoken about more, and I hope he's okay.
And Dave, one of your favorite books in football is A Life Too Short, an incredible book.
Oh, my God.
By Ronald Reng. It came out in 2012-ish. It's a biography of a Bundesliga captain, a goalkeeper who played for Germany. And this is dark. He committed suicide after years of depression, trying to battle just the incredible pressure of being an elite footballer. And goalkeepers, obviously, are very, very different. The pressure and scrutiny they're under is, I can't even imagine. So it is something that is obviously becoming more aware of, this issue of social media, which is not just a football issue. It's a society. I mean, society is currently buckling under just the mechanism of social media. Politically, we're all adjusting to it. So we are in football. It really accentuates the darkness. And we've just done an interview, which we're about to release, with the Canadian national team goalkeeper, Stephanie Labbé, who's an incredible human being. She has started to speak about it. We'll put it out, I think, in the next 2 weeks. But her through line, if you're not familiar with it, this is her third Olympic cycle. And the first one, just the psychological pressure of trying to compete for the job just was too much for her. And she had to tap out of performing. She couldn't cope. And she watched her team play and realized she missed it, loved it, got back into it, and then had an incredible tournament in her second Olympics. But the pressure, they won bronze, Canada, she was delirious with joy, but the post-tournament blues just put her in a terribly dark place again, which she speaks about with an incredible honesty, vulnerability, and poetic human wonder. And now she's going again, her third, probably final Olympics. And just hearing her articulate it, I think more footballers are starting to, as more athletes now feel more comfortable and confident talking about it. It's been one of the many issues the English national team have campaigned for, with Prince William, to be able to be overt and talk about the challenges you're feeling, as opposed to just repress them and keep them in. And I think it's something that we're only just starting to grapple with and feel through. And, you know, God, I mean, the Morata miss, all I can say is devastating humanly on so many levels. Go and find the Robert Enker book, Greg. It really is. It was opened my eyes in an astonishing fashion, and I hope it does for you too. Going to bring to the stage, hard to follow that question, going to bring double L. It's Lisa. It's Lawless. Oh, welcome to the stage, Lisa Lawless. Where are you from? And what's your question?
Milwaukee.
Oh!
$12. Yeah.
Hey, we're so happy for you. We are so bloody happy for you. Thank you for joining us with hangover, no doubt. What is your question?
Hopefully one tomorrow. Chiellini, or if I'm pronouncing it right, his face and his charisma jump off the screen even when you don't know what he sounds like. You just see it. And I keep looking at him thinking he looks like an American actor, and I can picture the American actor, but I can't remember his name either. So I Googled it, and it turns out there's a Lebanese-Swiss actor who they say looks just like Chiellini, named Faris Farris, who is in Star Wars Rogue One. I don't know if you know who I'm talking about, the American actor that Chiellini resembles, but to shift, who would play Jordan Pickford and Schmeichel in the movie version of their Euro game between them?
Oh, that is...
Sorry, go ahead, Roger.
No, I love it. Go on. All you.
I was thinking the same thing watching the game, that he reminded me so much of someone today. And then finally, right after the coin toss for the shootout, I turned to my mate in the restaurant I was watching. I said, it's Corey Stoll, who, remember, was in... Yeah, been a lot of roles, but in House of Cards, you know, played that, you know, Congressman Peter Russo, I believe. And he does have a bit of Corey Stoll. Now, of course, that is fellow bald to fellow bald. He is a wonderful bald man, a good looking, hard, tough bald man. One of my favorite varieties of human. But I do think he's got a bit of Corey Stoll about him, and I think that's who should play him in an American version of Italy-Spain in the semifinals of Euro 2020.
David Van Howe in the chat says that Chiellini is the parking attendant from Ferris Bueller, and once you think about that, you'll never unsee it. David Van Howe, you're a genius. To answer your question, Lisa Lawless, double L, I am going to say for the Schmeichel and Pickford piece, I love Fargo, the television show, and one of my favourites was when Ewan McGregor played two characters in the same show. So I would actually, Ewan McGregor, I'd have the same actor play both Jordan Pickford and Schmeichel, and I think it would be Gareth from The Office. It would be Mackenzie Crooks, who I think would be just, he's got that incredible range. But watching him in particular play Pickford, I could actually, I'd somehow write in a role for Jamie Vardy. I know he's not in the England squad right now, but I'd have Gareth Cooks playing Schmeichel, Pickford, and also Vardy, Eddie Murphy style. And it would be a magnificent piece of drama. Thank you for your gorgeous, gorgeous question. We are going to go to a tactical question. Oh, from the great Robert Waldron. Welcome. Where are you from and what's your question?
Hey, I'm calling here from Washington, D.C. area.
Where about, Robert Waldron?
In Maryland, actually.
Can we get a town or a city? We need it for our GPS focus on your question so we can really respond.
We're here calling from Rockville, Maryland, which is about 20 minutes from the White House.
We know it well. Yeah. We know it. I've got a feeling you might work for the CIA, not disclosing your location on a need to know basis. So are you in your phone is from a safe house somewhere in that area. What's the Robert Waldron question?
Well, first of all, I'm sure you have been looking forward to a possible England final in Wembley. I'm just wondering, how do you think how do you think England will start off their match versus Denmark? And obviously versus our last opponent. I think it must have been a goal at the beginning of each half. And I'm just wondering, do you think a slow start versus Denmark could be potentially difficult for England?
That's a great question, David.
Roger already teased that, and I do think statistically, without a doubt, if England don't score quickly, Denmark are going to stand a better chance. I do think England's bench is very good, and I think you're going to see that bench used in the second half, particularly if England are still trying to hold on and get a result there. I think one of the interesting questions for Southgate is going to be whether he plays three at the back and wings backs, or whether he sticks with the four that he's used for most of the tournament. Remember, he adjusted in the Germany game to play three at the back and wing backs. It means he had to lose one offensive player, because he's always going to play a double pivot. He's always going to play two defensive midfielders. And the question is, against Denmark, what does he do? And I think there is a lot of smart thinking which looks at when England have played Denmark before, because England played them twice in the last year. I think it was, I don't know if it was Nations League or World Cup qualifying, Roger. It was one of the two.
And Nations League.
They drew with them in Copenhagen and then lost to them at Wembley. A very rare loss for England at Wembley Stadium. They had, I think Harry Maguire was sent off in the first half and Reece James was sent off at the end, if I remember. And England lost 1-0.
It was the pinnacle of the Harry Maguire, Mykonos, personal meltdown time. And it was just a chaotic performance.
But Southgate played three at the back against them. And I think the reason he did is because the threats, and we've seen it with Meyer, with how good he's been with making those Danish goals from the wings. And I think that England may want to use wingbacks to pin the Danish wingers back. So I think you could see him play three at the back. If he plays four at the back, he's going to have an extra offensive player. I think Jadon Sancho is probably going to drop out and make room for Saka if that happens. If not, Jadon Sancho drops out. He's not. If he plays three at the back, nobody replaces him. He just plays Mount, Kane and Sterling up front. I think that is most likely. I don't think there's any doubt that he's going to play Kane and Sterling. I don't think there's any doubt he's going to play Phillips and Rice. I don't think there's any doubt that he's going to play Maguire and Stones at the back. I think Luke Shaw is going to be there too. So it's going to be tactically interesting. I think Denmark, on the other hand, are going to really figure out individual plans to take on England players. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see how they play Raheem Sterling, who without any doubt has been consistently England's most dangerous player of the tournament.
Let's go. Quick wrap-up round. These very patient GFOPs will try and get to you. Oh, let's bring up Kevin Wilson from New Zealand.
Hey, Rog and Dave, how are you?
Hey, Kevin, how you doing?
I feel as if Chris Wood himself has come on the green room.
Well, I was born not far away from you, Rog. I was born in Southport.
Honestly?
Oh, God. I love Southport.
Oh, my Lord. Southport is like it's the fancy beach town about 40 minutes away from Liverpool, where you'd aspire to go on holiday back in the day.
Ended up living in a very fancy beach town in Southern California in Laguna Beach.
Yes.
Listened to your show for 15 years there. Moved back to New Zealand and just, I can't find another brand of sports journalism like you guys.
Yeah, there is. That's very kind of you to call it a brand of sports journalism, Kevin. It's something.
Kevin, can I just say, you are our official New Zealand correspondent of the Green Room. Oh, let's do it. What's your question from our official New Zealand correspondent?
I had a variety of questions, actually, but possibly the two that stand out for me at the moment are, the final is about a team of stars against the strongest team. Of the three teams that are left, who do you think is the team of stars or the strongest team?
Whoa. That's a tough one. That is a tough one.
Well, look,
is it appropriate to not wear socks when coaching your national sports team?
Oh, you just brought me back memories of Shane Smeltz, Kevin Wilson. Great, great memories of Shane Smeltz. God, I don't think, I've got to tell you, I did not wear socks for 6 months after Miami Vice came out when I was 15. I wore women's espadrilles in Liverpool all winter with no socks. and I have never worn those socks again. I'm completely confused and befuddled. And when I see people on television going no sock in the studio, it like annoys me. I realize the annoyance is just my own jealousy that they're trying to pull it off. And I do hear that Guy Ritchie voice in my head saying it's a dangerous game. David, can you answer the serious question from Kevin Wilson, and then we'll blow through the other two and pull this together. And there's your answer.
Sorry, I had an incoming call. One of the problems on Spotify, get an Look, I think on the teams, these three teams are left in the tournament because they're great teams. But you have to look at Denmark to talk about a team and what that team have been through and the bonding they've had. And they are the most impressive team left in the tournament. And everything about them is team and team spirit and everything that's great about team sports. The team of stars, probably on paper in terms of their earnings and their transfer value, is England. It doesn't mean that they necessarily are front to back the team of stars, but probably in terms of the pressure that they feel as stars, it's probably them.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just say very, very quickly, we take on narrative from English media, and we read the English media and we see this tournament through the lens of the English media. And I think the Danish story, I can see a real shock tomorrow. I think the Danish team fancy their chances in every regard. I think they believe in themselves. I think their mood is just an umber. By the way, this English team culture is as good as I've ever seen at the tournament, so I wouldn't discount that. But I can definitely see in international football, the delirious collective is one of the greatest intangibles. And this is a mission-driven group of characters. And I can see them laying a... If England do not score early, the longer this game goes on, the more there's a chance for a shot. We will see tomorrow. I want to honour these two guys who've been holding out. Lindsay Barnes, a great classic GFOP. Welcome to the stage. Where are you and what's your question?
Thank you, Raj. I'm coming to you today from Arlington, Virginia.
Oh, beautiful, beautiful part of our nation. What's your question, LB?
Question is, with Italy through to the final, do Denmark or England have a prayer of winning the anthem?
God. You know, if you used to watch Italy play, I'll tell you something quite funny. In the history of Italian football, there was a tournament, I need to look this up, I wrote about it once, where they took crap from across Italy because their players didn't even know the words to the Italian national anthem. And Italians on this green room, please email me if I'm wrong here or if I'm telling the story badly. But Italy, you know, is one of, I love Italy. I go there every opportunity. I miss it terribly during lockdown. I try and go every year. And it still sees itself historically, deeply, regionally, you know, where you're from your region. That's where you feel, you know, some towns you even feel closest to your neighborhood. And the idea of Italy, a united Italy, still relatively new. I mean, Garibaldi it up. It was only, when was it, like 1830s, whatever, 1870s.
Yeah, unification, yeah.
And so they don't really see themselves often. And the Italian footballer, I think it was 1982, they had to do a press conference where they apologized to the nation. They were not singing their national anthem very well. They said, most of us do not know the words because we've never sung it before. You know, at school, they sang local songs, not the national anthem. And so if you look at footage, and there is some on YouTube of them singing it in the 80s, they barely, one or two of them knew the words. The rest just stood there. And I think the Italian passion we see now is coming in reaction to that. It's coming in reaction to culture, society changing, politics changing in ways that, knowing Italy, all I know about Italy is however much you think you know from the outside, you know very little. But I think whatever is going on in Italy that they sing it, it's so deeply joyful to watch. But there's something very remarkable societally that's going on there. And they do. David and I once had a near punch-up in our 2014 coverage of the World Cup. I actually said at the time, I was like, England are out. You know, you can see Costa Rica, watch how they sing the national anthem. And we sing it terribly. The English lads, it's now de rigueur. It is amazing to watch them, Dave, English footballers singing that national anthem. They didn't used to 10 years ago.
No. You're absolutely right. Yeah, I think we can say that Italy are going to win the national anthem. I think that they've already won it. We may as well just hand over that trophy right now.
Which ultimately is the only one that matters. I'd love to know from people who truly understand the Italian politics where that's coming from. It's itching a scratch that I don't fully understand and would love to dig deeper on. Last question of
thanks,
the
Raj,
day.
Love the
from
book.
The great name from the thank you, gorgeous. From the great named if it isn't Mr. Seamus Toner. Welcome, where are you from and what's your question?
Hello, I'm from Tallahassee, Florida, and my question is, what will we see more of or see/hear more of tomorrow? Will the announcers reference Casper Dolberg's stolen watch more, or will Harry Kane score? So, I guess, sorry, that was my daughter.
What's her question?
Sorry, my daughter started screaming. She said she's not sure if it's going to come home, but...
what's her name?
Her name is Bridget.
Great name.
Devo, what are we going to see more of? Dolberg watch references or Harry Kane goes? Here's my reality. David, I don't know if you've got a comment on that.
Well, I assume that because it's John Champion and Taylor Twellman today, that tomorrow is going to be Ian Dark and Stuart Robson, in which case I think there will be less references to the stolen watch, although Ian Dark may surprise us and sneak a couple in. It's tough to say. If it was 12, I'd be completely the other way around.
I mean, here's the reality. I have thought about this a lot, Seamus Toner, in Tallahassee, Florida. If I were Gareth Southgate, I would play sight games with the Danish team. I know they're going to make a presentation, as every team has done when they played Denmark, to Christian Eriksen. But I would also send my captain out. I'd send Harry Kane out to the centre circle with a $90,000 watch. And I would just have him present
perfect.
It right to Dolberg, right then and there.
And just say,
this is, you lost one that was 85,000. Lads did a whip around. This one's 95,000. Now piss off.
What would be amazing is if also Roger, it was an absolute replica of the one he had stolen. So that he's confused between, is this an act of generosity or are these the guys who stole my watch?
Mate, through the fence, Sue Harry, the fence. Got a bit of property. I think that's how you defang the Danes, though. You give them the watch. Davo, when are we going to be back on Spotify?
We're going to be back on Spotify tomorrow, Rog. We're assuming if England lose one in penalties, I might not be back on Spotify. I just want to tell you right now. But no, I'll figure it out. I won't watch the penalty shootout because I don't regard it as a legitimate way to end a game, a major game in a tournament.
Agree. If they're not going to have the managers do the decent thing and just eat pies, then I don't care for it.
Yeah. We'll be back sort of the same time, same channel, right after tomorrow's Epic Clash. We don't know if it's going to end after 90 plus minutes or it's going to go after extra time or after penalties. But before we sign off for the day, Rog, can we get a toast?
Oh, mate, a raise, this shot of Jägermeister, this shot of human emotion in a glass to the fact that we are less than 24 hours away from one of the most remarkable moments in modern English footballing history. The English national team, that New York Knicks of world football, will take the field at Wembley and attempt to qualify for their first major tournament final since 1966. 55 years of hurt, 55 years of dreams, of shattered deep dreams, of trauma, repression, self-sabotage. And for this to happen after the past 17 months in which Britain has been ravaged by the pandemic is simply remarkable. Make no mistake, Britain, still politically, culturally a divided nation, a truth reflected in the ugly scenes ahead of the tournament, surrounding the outcry over teams taking a knee. But even those who once derided the English national team have climbed on their bandwagon as they near glory and have raised this shot to Gareth Southgate and his act of national levitation. Courage.
Oh, Roger, it was actually quite moving to me as remaining a Briton, an Englishman.
I don't care.
No, clearly not. Clearly not. Your pronouns aren't at all confused going into tomorrow. Vendepunk.
War pig.
Was that a Rabona?
I like snacks.
Baldwin.
Cellini. Take that, Gloria.
Balds lose.
To Tweed.
Abrigado, rock on, mate.
Chung Fu Fine America. Love you, Davo.
Love you, Rog.
Love you, Green Room.
Hey, Prime members. You can listen to Men in Blazers ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
If you travel for work, you know to pack 2 suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you-know-business.